and convince Philip and the others to stop the fighting. But he refused, saying he knew the Indians would not yield. He was then transported to Stonington, where officials blamed him for dragging the Narragansetts into war. He responded that others were as forward for the war as himself, and that he desired to hear no more thereof. When told he'd been sentenced to die, he replied that he liked it well, that he should die before his heart was soft or had spoken anything unworthy of himself. Just prior to his execution in front of a Pequot firing squad, Canonchet declared that killing him would not end the war. When Uncas's son responded that he was a rogue, Canonchet defiantly threw off his jacket and stretched out his arms just as the bullets pierced his chest. Connecticut officials made sure that all three factions of their friendly Indians shared in the execution. According to one account, the Pequots shot him, the Mohegans cut off his head and quartered his body, and Ninigrettes, Nyantics, made the fire and burned his quarters, and as a token of their love and fidelity to the English, presented his head to the council at Hartford. If the death of Canonchet did not end the war, it was, in Hubbard's words, a considerable step thereunto. The Indians had lost a leader whose bravery and magnetism had briefly united several groups of native peoples into a powerful and effective fighting force. In the days and weeks ahead, dissension began to threaten the Indians as the English belatedly came to realize that the praying Indians were the best ones to drive home the wedge that might break apart the Nipmuc-Narragansett-Poconocket alliance. The wedge? A 38-year-old English captive named Mary Rowlandson. By late March, a large number of Indians had gathered at Mount Wachusett to the north of modern Worcester. The steep and rocky terrain provided them with protection from the English, yet was far enough east that they could easily attack the towns between them and Boston. On April 5th, the praying Indian Tom Doublet arrived at Wachusett with a letter from colonial officials in Boston. In addition to the possibility of opening peace negotiations, the letter mentioned the release of English prisoners. On April 12th, Doublet returned to Boston with the Indians' response. They were in no mood, as of yet, to discuss peace. You know and we know your heart great sorrowful with crying, for you lost many, many hundred men and all your houses and your land and women, child and cattle. You on your backside stand. They were willing, however, to discuss the possibility of ransoming hostages. As a minister's wife, Mary Rowlandson was the Indians' most notable captive, and she inevitably became the focus of the negotiations. In mid-April, Rowlandson, who was still in the vicinity of the Connecticut River with Weetamoo, learned that her presence was required at Wachusett, where Philip and her master Quinnipin were already meeting with the Nipmucks. Before receiving this news, she had reached a new nadir. Her son, she had learned, was racked by the flux and was infested with lice. She had heard nothing about her daughter. Without Quinnipin to intervene, Rowlandson's relationship with Weetamoo, difficult from the start, had deteriorated to the point that the sachem had threatened to beat her with a log. My heart was so heavy that I could scarce speak or walk along the path, she remembered. But when she learned that she might soon be ransomed to the English, she felt a sudden resurgence of energy. My strength seemed to come again, she wrote, and recruit my feeble knees and aching heart. Rowlandson arrived at Mount Wachusett in the midst of preparations to attack the town of Sudbury. With the death of Canonchet having already begun to erode native confidence, the Indians urgently needed a major victory. They were winning the war, but they were without significant reserves of food. Even if they succeeded in growing a significant amount of corn, they couldn't harvest the crop until late summer. In June, the groundnuts went to seed and became inedible. They must force the English to sue for peace before the beginning of summer. Otherwise, no matter how great their military victories, they would begin to starve to death. On April 17th, Rowlandson became one of the few Westerners to witness a native war dance. In the center of a large ring of kneeling warriors, who rhythmically struck the ground with their palms and sang, were two men, one of whom held a musket and a deerskin. As the man with the gun stepped outside the ring, the other made a speech, to which the warriors in the ring enthusiastically responded. Then the man at the center began to call for the one with the gun to return to the deerskin, but the outsider refused. As the warriors in the ring chanted and struck the ground, the armed man slowly began to yield and re-entered the ring. Soon after, the drama was repeated, this time with the man holding two guns. Once the leader of the dance had made another speech, and the warriors had all assented in a rejoicing manner, it was time to leave for Sudbury. It was a smashing native victory. Two different companies of English militia fell victim to ambush. The Indians killed as many as 74 men and suffered minimal losses, and yet the Sudbury fight failed to be the total, overwhelming triumph the Indians had hoped for. They came home, Rowlandson remembered, without that rejoicing and triumphing over their victory, which they were wont to show at other times, but rather like dogs, as they say, which have lost their ears. Even though they had inflicted terrible damage, there were still plenty of English left to fight another day, and for the Indians, the days were running out. The negotiations with the English took on a new urgency. The sachems ordered Rowlandson to appear before them in what they described as their general court. They wanted to know what she thought she was worth. It was an impossible question, of course, but Rowlandson named the figure of £20 sterling. In the letter accompanying their ransom request, the sachems, led by the Nipmuc known as Sagamore Sam, adopted a far less arrogant tone. "I am sorry that I have done much wrong to you," the note read, "and yet I say the fate is lay upon you, for when we began quarrel at first with Plymouth men, I did not think that you should have so much trouble as now is." In early May, the praying Indians Tom Doublet and Peter Conway arrived with the Englishman John Hoare from Concord. In addition to the ransom money, Hoare had brought along some provisions to help facilitate the negotiations. It soon emerged that Philip was against the ransoming of English captives, while the Nipmucks were for it. However, since Rowlandson was owned by Quinnipin, it was ultimately up to him. Traditionally, Native Americans relied on the ritual of the dance to help them arrive at important decisions. The dance that day was led by four sachems and their wives, including Quinnipin and Weetamoo. Even though both of them had been almost constantly on the run for the last few months, the couple still possessed the trappings of nobility. "He was dressed in his Holland shirt," Rowlandson wrote, "with great laces sewed at the tail of it. He had his silver buttons, his white stockings, his garters were hung round with shillings, and he had girdles of wampum upon his head and shoulders. She had a kersey, a twilled woolen fabric coat, and covered with girdles of wampum from the loins upward. Her arms, from her elbows to her hands, were covered with bracelets. There were handfuls of necklaces about her neck and several sorts of jewels in her ears. She had fine red stockings and white shoes, her hair powdered and face painted red that was always before black." That night, Quinnipin sent a message to John Hoare that he would release Rowlandson the next day if, in addition to the ransom of £20 sterling, he should let him have 1 pint of liquor. Hearing of the Narragansett sachem's offer, Philip ordered Rowlandson to come before him. "He asked me what I would give him to speak a good word for me." She asked what it was he wanted. Philip's reply, 2 coats, 20 shillings, a half bushel of seed corn, and some tobacco. It was the same ploy he had used 10 years before on Nantucket Island, an extortion attempt that once again made him appear bullying and opportunistic. As his earlier acts of kindness toward Rowlandson had indicated, Philip was better than this. As the night wore on, Quinnipin became roaring drunk. "He came ranting into the wigwam," Rowlandson remembered, "and called for Mr. Hoare, drinking to him and saying he was a good man, and then again he would say, 'Hang him, rogue.'" Quinnipin then ordered Rowlandson to come before him, and after drinking to her, but showing no incivility, he began to chase his young wife around the wigwam, the shillings attached to his pants jingling at his knees. His wife proved too fast for him and escaped to another wigwam. But having an old squaw, Rowlandson wrote, he ran to her, and so, through the Lord's mercy, we were no more troubled that night. The next morning, the sachems held another meeting, a meeting that Philip, who apparently did not receive his coats and tobacco, refused to attend. To Rowlandson's great joy, it was decided that she should be released. To this day, the place where she gained her freedom, marked by a huge glacier-scored boulder, is known as Redemption Rock. By sundown, Rowlandson, Hoare, and the two praying Indians had reached her former home of Lancaster, where they decided to spend the night. "And a solemn sight it was to me," she wrote. "There had I lived many comfortable years amongst my relations and neighbors, and now not one Christian to be seen, nor one house left standing." They reached Concord the next day around noon, and by evening they were in Boston, "where I met," Rowlandson recalled, "my dear husband. But the thoughts of our dear children, one being dead and the others we could not tell where, abated our comfort each to other." Over the course of the next few months, both their children were released, and they spent the rest of the war living among friends in Boston. But Rowlandson found it difficult to leave her captivity behind. "I can remember the time when I used to sleep quietly without workings in my thoughts, whole nights together," she wrote. "But now is other ways with me. When others are sleeping, mine eyes are weeping." It was a new era in the war. With the success of Tom Doublet and Peter Conway in negotiating the release of Mary Rowlandson, and with increasing numbers of Massachusetts Bay officers using praying Indians as scouts, even Samuel Moseley came to see the light, New Englanders began to realize that it was both stupid and inhumane to keep hundreds of loyal Indians sequestered against their will. In the middle of May, the Massachusetts General Court ordered that the praying Indians be removed from Deer Island. "This deliverance," Daniel Gookin wrote, "was a jubilee to those poor creatures." On May 18th, Captain William Turner, with 150 volunteers from Hatfield, Hadley, and Northampton, attacked a large native fishing camp on the Connecticut River. Although Turner and his men were ambushed during their retreat and more than 40 Englishmen, including Turner, were killed, they had succeeded in killing hundreds of Indians. On June 9th, the Nipmuc leader, Sagamore Sam, lost his wife in another English assault. The Nipmucs decided they must sue for peace. Unwilling to become a Nipmuc bargaining chip, Philip, accompanied by Quinnipin and Weetamoo, left Mount Wachusett and headed south into familiar territory. With his brother-in-law Tuspiquin, the black sachem of Nemasket, leading the charge, Philip's people attacked towns throughout Plymouth and Rhode Island. From his temporary home on Aquidneck Island, Benjamin Church could see the smoke rising from locations up and down Narragansett Bay. Communication was difficult in these dangerous times, and they were all anxious for any word about their loved ones and friends. On May 12th, Alice gave birth to a son named Constant in honor of her father. A few days later, Church took up a knife and stick and began to whittle. He'd been out of the war now for more than 3 months, and he wasn't sure what he should do now that his son had been born. Perhaps he should take up carpentry. But as he whittled the stick, his hand slipped and he badly gashed two of his fingers. Church smiled. If he was going to injure himself, he might as well do it in battle. It was time he returned to the war. Chapter 16. The Better Side of the Hedge. On Tuesday, June 6th, Benjamin Church attended a meeting of the General Court in Plymouth. Travel in the colony was still dangerous, but Church had managed to hitch a ride on a sloop from Newport to Cape Cod. The Cape and islands had remained free of violence throughout the first year of the war. Instead of treating their large praying Indian population with cruelty and distrust, the English inhabitants had relied on them for their protection. As a result, the Cape had become the colony's one oasis of safety, and Church used it to good effect, securing a house in modern Falmouth, then known as Second Essex, and riding north along the eastern shore of Buzzards Bay to Sandwich and then on to Plymouth. More than 3 months had passed since the Council of War had refused his request to lead a large group of Native Americans against Philip. Over that brief span of time, English attitudes toward the praying Indians had undergone a fundamental change, just as the main theater of the war shifted back to Plymouth Colony. Church sensed that his time had finally arrived. As it so happened, the Council of War had decided to do almost exactly as Church had proposed back in February. They planned to send out in a few weeks' time a force of 300 soldiers, a third of them Indians, under the command of Major Bradford. Connecticut and the Bay Colony had also promised to provide companies that included significant numbers of Native scouts. This was all good news, of course, but Church had no intention of serving under Bradford. Bradford was a trustworthy and loyal officer, but Church had his own ideas about how to fight the war. He must find an army of his own. 2 days later, Church was in a canoe with two Cape Indians headed back to Aquidneck Island. They were approaching the rocky shore of Sakonnet at the southeastern corner of Narragansett Bay. This was the home of Awashonks, the female sachem whom Church had known before the war. He was certain that if given the opportunity, Awashonks would have aligned herself with the English. Instead, she'd taken her people across the bay to the then-neutral Narragansetts. After the Great Swamp Fight, the Sakonnets had been forced north along with the Narragansetts and eventually made their way to Mount Wachusett. As Church and his two Indian guides approached the jagged rocks and pebble beach of Sakonnet, he saw some of the sachem's Indians fishing in the surf. The Sakonnets, Church realized, had returned home. Perhaps he could convince them to abandon Philip and serve under him. The Indians began to shout and make signs that Church should come ashore, but when the canoe approached, they retreated and hid amid the clefts of the rocks. Fearful that the Sakonnets might be luring him into a trap, Church ordered the Cape Indians to back away from shore. Over the next few minutes, as the canoe rose up and down with the rhythmic heave of the ocean swell, the Sakonnets and Cape Indians struck up a conversation in their native language. But it was difficult for them to hear each other above the crashing surf. Church used hand signals to indicate that he was willing to meet with just two of them at the end of a nearby point of sand. After pulling the canoe up on shore, Church realized that one of the Indians was an old friend named Honest George. George, who spoke English well, said that Church's suspicions were correct. Awashonks had left Philip and did not intend to return to him anymore. Church asked George to deliver a message to his sachem. In 2 days, he would meet her and just two others at a well-known rock near the western shore of Sakonnet. The next day, Church went to Newport to inform the authorities of his proposed meeting with Awashonks. Since the Sakonnets were regarded as the enemy, he needed official sanction. But the Rhode Island officials refused to grant him a permit, claiming Church was mad and would most certainly be killed if he dared meet with the Sakonnets. Church, however, resolved to go ahead with the meeting, with or without the authorities' blessing. He purchased a bottle of rum and a roll of tobacco to assist with the negotiations, and on the morning of the next day he and the two Cape Indians prepared to paddle to Sakonnet. But Alice refused to let them go. The Rhode Islanders were right, it was too dangerous. Church did his best to convince his tender and now broken-hearted wife that he must go. He assured her that this was nothing compared to the dangers he had already survived. If God looked favorably on his meeting with Awashonks, it might be of great service to the colony. Finally, Alice relented, committing her, his babes, and himself to heaven's protection. Church set out for Sakonnet. It was just a 3-mile paddle from the Almy House on the east shore of Aquidneck Island to the meeting place. As Church had hoped, he could see some Indians waiting on the bank. One of them was Honest George, who said that Awashonks was nearby and willing to meet with him. When Church asked if she had come with just two others, George did not have time to reply before Awashonks came down to the shore with her son Peter and her principal warrior, Nampak.